proud defender of the working class majority. Rick Smith.
Well, as crazy as the Trump administration has been, with all of its kleptocracy and all of the waste, the fraud, the abuse, all of the doors for Ryan Zinke's office, all of the Superman phone booths over at the EPA, all of that, the Ben Carson dining room table, all of that, the drapes, don't forget the drapes for Nikki Haley, and just all of this, hey, look, needed an upgrade. You know, the Obama years, a little drab. Didn't have real style. Needed people with good taste, the best people with the best tastes to come in and, well, spend our money on things that they like. And maybe when they leave, they'll take them as parting gifts. And, you know, if they go soon, maybe I wouldn't be against them taking it. But I saw this story, and look, I never thought Ben Carson was anywhere near qualified to be the head of the Housing and Urban Development section. Never really thought he should be anywhere near, maybe not even near the building, let alone in charge of it. And now I see he's really not. This idea that during the Obama years, they actually thought that maybe they should fight segregation. I mean, it is part of the idea that, you know, they founded the whole institution under, that we would try and get, you know, redlining gone. And, you know, like where I grew up in Cleveland as a kid, everything was very segregated. You knew where you belonged. And the idea was to kind of break that down. Evidently, we're making America great again by, well, slicing and dicing and segregating. And here to share some thoughts on, well, what Ben Carson's doing, why he's doing it, and, well, why it's a bad idea. I've asked Heidi Schulteis to come talk with us. She's a policy analyst on the Poverty to Prosperity team over at the Center for American Progress. Heidi, thanks for taking time for us.
Absolutely. Thanks very much for having me, Rick.
So we're making America great again by putting those people where they belong, those poor people where they belong.
That is really what it feels like we're moving toward right now. So as you noticed in our Talk Poverty post about the Affirmatively Furthering Fair Housing Rule, we're really concerned that HUD is going to ultimately kind of kill this by indefinitely suspending it. And AFFH is essential to reducing housing segregation. So I'd love to just delve into that a little bit, if that's okay.
Yeah, absolutely. Because I was going to ask you, what is AFFH?
Yeah, it's a mouthful. And we've actually lamented this as we work through various products at Center for American Progress. It is a mouthful. Affirmatively Furthering Fair Housing is the name of the rule. So it's important to understand the rule a little bit in context. The Fair Housing Act, some people know, was signed exactly 50 years ago in 1968 by President Lyndon Johnson, and it included a provision called Affirmatively Furthering Fair Housing. And the goal of that provision was to undo discriminatory housing policies and also to remedy the harm that they had caused. And so the act prohibited discrimination regarding the sale, rental, and financing of housing based on protected classes like race, religion, national origin, and then later other protected classes like gender and disability status were added. And so this all sounds really good, and it actually looked really good on paper, too. And the problem was there was no serious enforcement mechanism, and so communities continued to accept HUD funding without actually abiding by the AFFH provision. And truthfully, even if communities had wanted to follow the AFFH provision, there wasn't really any guidance for them to do so.
Right.
And so this is where the Affirmatively Furthering Fair Housing Rule comes in, and that's what we're really talking about today. So the rule, in 2015, the Obama administration created the AFFH rule along with several different assessment tools so that communities that receive HUD funding could capture complete uniform data and so that they could identify things like residential segregation, concentration of poverty, and lack of access to opportunity, and create meaningful and measurable goals to actually remedy those problems.
Right, but do we need a data collecting mechanism to tell us what I think everybody already knows? I mean, if you've driven through any major city, look, I grew up in Cleveland, and I can tell you where the lines are all drawn. I can tell you where the black neighborhoods are, the Hispanic neighborhoods, the Muslim neighborhoods, the poor white neighborhoods, the more affluent neighborhoods. I can tell you where all of those sections are and which roads, demark each one of those and maybe where you should stay out of and at what times. I don't think we need, do we need a data collecting mechanism? Since I think you live in any major city, you see it right in front of you played out.
Yeah, I think your description of being able to identify kind of different neighborhood barriers and where different communities live and where minority communities live, that's the experience of a lot of people. That's true in Cleveland. It's true in a lot of cities. And so Carson is actually asking the very same thing. HUD is asking the same thing. You know, do we really need to collect data about these things, or, you know, does the data really have to be uniform? And the answer unequivocally is yes, right? Because without sort of not only collecting data, but collecting data in a really uniform way from communities across the country, we just don't know. There's no way for HUD to really know where segregation is happening, how it's happening, on what scale, where there's concentration of poverty.
I got to tell you, now there's a difference between me and Ben Carson. I would like to believe that, you know, we could probably go to any major city, pull, you know, 10 people out, and they can all tell you where all this stuff is. The difference is I think he's okay with things being segregated just the way they are, as where I think, you know, I think economic opportunity being one of the main drivers, I think we need to figure out how to break some of this stuff up. So I think we would come at it from a very different point of view. But, I look at all the data collection. You know, what are we going to do with this data once we have it? Because my problem is we collect data on a lot of stuff, and nothing ever gets done with it. I mean, we've got a lot of stuff, but we don't have much in the way of action. So once we collect this data, what's the way forward?
Yeah, you know what? You bring up a great and really timely point. We live in an era of big data, and sometimes it feels like we have lots of data collection that we're not sure what happens with that data. And in the case of the AFFH rule, that's actually spot on, because the rule was only implemented 3 years ago. And so we really haven't had enough time pass to be able to say for sure exactly where in this or that city or this or that community there's segregation that we can analyze, and there's concentration of poverty that we can identify and analyze and work toward remedying. So there have only been out of a total of about 1,200 communities that receive HUD funding and therefore need to comply with the AFFH rule, only 49 so far have been required to submit analyses that comply with the AFFH rule to HUD. So only 49 communities have submitted those analyses, and almost all of them were ultimately accepted, which means that they did their analyses properly and that they formed really meaningful, measurable goals toward working on the problems that they identified. And so Carson claims that actually there's been some high failure rate in what we've seen so far. And that's just not right. And like I said earlier, there's only been 3 years to collect so far. We've got a long way to go.
Right. But here's my problem. I look at Carson, and Carson, is somebody who I think he's hostile to the mission of the organization to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
So, when you start from a place of, I want to destroy this, are you surprised that, this is happening?
Oh my gosh, not at all. This is just one of many attacks on basic living standards that we've seen from the Trump administration. And you can start just by looking at attacks on housing and actions taken by HUD. There's a clear pattern here. Earlier this year, this was fairly widely covered. Carson tried to remove language about inclusivity and discrimination from the HUD mission statement. What a bold, blatant move. And he only backed down from that after receiving considerable media coverage and criticism and input from, you know, career employees at HUD. Last fall, another attack, HUD tried to delay implementing a rule adopted during the Obama years that was intended to fight segregation among households that use federal rental vouchers, most of whom are people of color. And a district court in D.C. Overruled that and or ruled against that, and begrudgingly HUD is having to implement that. So this latest attempt, which is to indefinitely delay, which ultimately means to kill, the AFFH rule, is just the latest attack. I'm sure it won't be the last either.
Right. But what do you say to the person who says, you know, segregation is just the natural order of things? And I've had people make this argument to me, that people want to live amongst like-minded, you know, like-incomed, like-valued groups. We're very tribal, and that, you know, we want to be amongst our own. And why should a government agency force us to not do what is, in some people's view, natural, and that is to segregate our to self-segregate?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're right. This is something. This is definitely a question that people ask, and that Carson asked himself. And I think he's, if I remember correctly, he's referred to efforts to desegregate communities as social engineering. And so the problem with the argument that you just laid out is that there's nothing natural about the way that segregation has come to be in this country. In his book called The Color of Law, Richard Rothstein actually lays out in detail decades and decades of U.S. housing policy that has specifically discriminated against communities of color, that has made it harder for them to rent, that has made it much harder for them to access credit and financing for home purchasing, that has dictated where they can and cannot live. And there's nothing organic or natural about the way that segregation has come about in this country. And therefore, and this is a really important part, we can't sit back and hope that somehow organically segregation is going to come to an end. Segregation was engineered by housing policy in this country, and we need housing policy to remedy it.
No, I'm with you. But, you know, I go back to my own experience. I grew up in a housing project on the west side of Cleveland. I was the minority in a minority area. We used to play this neat game called Chase the White Kid and beat the snot out of him. And I'm sure it was probably a fun game had I not been the white kid. But, you know, eventually, you know, my mother, you know, we ended up getting some Section 8 housing assistance. And we moved out of there into a neighborhood that was, you know, a huge step up. And, you know, as a kid who grew up, in American poverty, that step up into the next, the lower middle class, if you will, was a huge values change. And, you know, for me, I see that there is a massive societal benefit to giving people who start off at the bottom of the rung an opportunity to move into another class, if you will, and experience their values and be pulled along, as opposed to having this constant segregation of this is where the poor people are going to be. And this is where the poor white people will be, the poor black people will be there, and the poor Hispanic people are there, and we'll segment ourselves off. So I see there's some really good societal benefits by having that hand up, if you will, and especially when you're pulling people into different environments. I think it's a benefit to those people. And I think in your article, you point out about New Orleans, where a kid growing up in one neighborhood, if he makes it to 65 or 67, I think it was, winner, you won the game because most of you weren't going to make it. Whereas just a couple miles away, their life expectancy was like another 20 years longer, which again, I think highlights the point of why you want to have this kind of policy that's going to encourage pulling kids like me out of neighborhoods like that and giving opportunities so that you can do better and that you can strive for better opportunity.
Yeah, I think...
Does that make sense?
It does make sense to me. Yeah, I think we've had... there's always going to be, I think, kind of a natural tension between investing in people and investing in place, right? And we've had sort of efforts at both, and we've had successes and failures in both of those realms. What we're seeing today, though, is really persistent segregation and concentration of poverty and lack of access to opportunity. And I think there's really an argument to be made that while, you know, similar to your experience of moving out of one neighborhood and into another, there have been experiments like the Gautreaux experiment in Chicago, the Moving to Opportunity or MTO program that took place in several major cities. There's definitely a lot of evidence that shows that moving families into low poverty, high opportunity neighborhoods has all kinds of benefits for them. At the same time, you know, right now in major metropolitan areas of the Midwest and Northeast, 70% or more of African Americans would have to move to a different neighborhood in order to achieve greater integration and be less isolated from white households. That's staggering, 70% or more. Communities of color that were redlined in the 1930s still face patterns of segregation and disinvestment similar to those of that era. Yeah. And so I think, you know, AFFH is both about being, the intent is so that communities can identify where there are, you know, problems in their housing landscape, and also to develop goals to remedy those problems. And the only remedy, right, is not just going to be up and moving everyone to kind of greater opportunity, lower poverty neighborhoods. Right. That, like I said, that has been proven to have all kinds of really positive outcomes for families that have been able to do that kind of thing and to participate in programs that allow them to do that and to have vouchers that allow them to do that. And at the same time, really the intent behind AFFH is to make every community a hub of opportunity and integration and positive outcomes for residents, and to really empower the community to be part of deciding how they're going to do that for themselves rather than just, you know, a kind of solution that would pick everyone up and move them to a better neighborhood.
So last line of questioning I've got for you, you know, what are the policy choices that you'd like to see? If you were Ben Carson, what are the policies that you think would help move us in a direction that would be, that would help change this scenario?
Oh gosh.
I'm sure there are thousands, say, but you know, throw out just a couple of the big ones. I mean, I'm sure you guys work on this stuff all the time. You know, what do you think the big buck bang one would be?
My gosh, the one that comes to mind, because we're in such a crisis mode right now in most cities in this country, especially large cities, and particularly there's been a lot of focus on cities up and down the West Coast, is the affordable housing crisis. And investing in increasing housing stock in those cities, as well as specifically increasing affordable housing stock, as well as investing more than we ever have, rather than disinvesting, as the Trump administration wants to do, in federal rental assistance programs, things like you mentioned, voucher programs, public housing, project-based subsidies. They're in incredibly short supply, and we're reaching crisis levels in many cities in terms of a lack of affordability, and the ultimate sort of consequence of that, which is a massive rise in homelessness.
Right.
And so one thing I just want to really emphasize, and of course this is something we talk about in the Tuck Poverty piece that you mentioned, is we really want to encourage people to submit public comments. I can't stress enough how important it is for people to submit public comments. Especially, this is a great opportunity. If you're frustrated with Congress, if you're frustrated with the president, if you're frustrated with your local government, they don't speak for you. You get to speak for yourself when you submit public comments. You don't need to be a policy expert. You don't need to have any special background. You can write about anything, even your very personal experiences. And someone reads every comment, and the volume of comments really matters. And at the bottom of our Talk Poverty post, we have a little guide where someone can click on a link that takes them to the register to submit comments, and also a link to take them to a website that can give you some tips and guidance if you're feeling a little bit wary about how to submit those comments.
And we can make sure we get that out so folks can take a look at it.
The deadline, I want to just drive home. The deadline is Monday, so make sure you write those comments this weekend.
Get right to it. Although, in addition to subsidies and all of that, I did want to throw out, I think, massive investment in public transportation and a jobs program. I've always been a fan of getting rid of handout programs and having nothing but jobs program, living wage jobs program. If the private sector can't or won't create enough jobs, I think the public sector has to create those jobs to give people opportunity to have that. To have that career base, that job base, to help them.
I think I couldn't agree more that equitable, transit-oriented development and employment programs—they all intersect so much with housing, as do things like education and health and everything else. And HUD and housing policy have a really important role to play there.
Good stuff, Heidi. I appreciate the time. It was really great talking with you. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Rick.
Always great to talk to our friends over at the Center for American Progress. If you want to check out Heidi's work, we'll make sure we get links out so folks can take a look at the piece on Ben Carson and also get your comments in. And please do get the comments in. Quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.